Go down the rabbit hole with Alice in Political Land, Facts and Fantasy, as host Dr. Peggy Weierman examines the strange, absurd, and often frightening myths being fostered by our politicians and the media about our families, communities, and nation. Like Alice in Alice in Wonderland, Peggy brings common sense and astute questions to the experts she interviews. Stop listening to sound bites and fantasy solutions. Start understanding the facts necessary for realistic solutions. Listen to Peggy and her guests who deal in reality. Now, here she is.
My name is Dr. Peggy Weierman. I'm the host of this show, Alice in Political Land, Fact and Fantasies. Alice, as you may remember from the movie or the book, Alice in Wonderland, fell down a rabbit hole into a place where everything was topsy-turvy, and it looked like that what was so wasn't really so. So today we're going to talk about a case where a situation in which we think we've accomplished something that we haven't accomplished. We think that we put people in jail, just lock them up, and that's the end of it. But in fact, that's not really true. Some 600,000 to 700,000 prisoners every year come back out of jail into our communities. 95% of prisoners will come home. So the question is, what happens to them then? If they're lucky enough to hook up with the program at the Madison Urban Ministry, that the rate that they go back into prison is drastically reduced. Actually, about almost 70% of prisoners return, that come back into the community, return to jail. But if they go to the MUM program, that rate drops to 10%. So it's now my pleasure to introduce Linda Ketchum, who's the executive director of the program. First, Linda, what accounts for the high rate of going back into jail?
A lot of the recidivism rate, and I'll clarify, when we talk about recidivism in our agency, we're talking about returning to prison for any reason, so either a new crime or having violated the rules of your supervision. And a lot of what happens is that the people get violated, their supervision is violated because they broke one of the rules or several of the rules of their supervision, and so they are returned to prison to complete their sentence. If you're only looking at new crimes in Wisconsin, the Department of Corrections, I think, estimates that the recidivism rate, they look at just new crimes, and that's 25 to 30% recidivism rate. But if you look at people going back for either or rule violation, new crime, it is 60 to 70%. And the caveat is sometimes somebody might commit a new crime, but a district attorney may decide not to pursue prosecuting them on the new crime because they can simply be sent back to prison on a revocation, and it saves the taxpayers some money in terms of a trial. So that 30% for new crimes may be low because not everything is reported in there. So, but anyway, it is, I mean, in terms of going back to prison for any reason, it is up 60 to 70%. A majority of that is violating the rules of supervision.
So how does your program help that? What actually happens how does a prisoner get into your program, and what happens?
Well, we reach out to people in a couple of ways. One, we might meet them in prison. We do what we call in-reach into several institutions. So we have staff who go into several of the prisons on a regular basis to meet people who are coming back to our area, to talk about the programming that we have, to see if they're interested. And if they are, then we can start things rolling there before they get out. And ideally, we're looking to connect with people 6 to 9 months from their release date so that we can maybe have some things in place for them. We have the majority of people come to us, just walk into the office, having been released usually within the first week we see them. Often on the first day they get out, their probation or parole agent may send them over. The first step is an orientation, and that's where we just start to get a sense of kind of who they are, what their strengths are, what their needs are. They get to get information about what the programming is. From there, if they are interested, then we start they have an individual appointment. We start the intake process and just getting to know them, setting some goals, understanding who they are, what they want to accomplish, and they begin to work with the staff toward reaching those goals. Or in one of our programs, Circles of Support, the process is they apply for a Circle of Support. A Circle of Support is a group of volunteers from the community, usually from specific faith communities, who agree to meet once a week with someone who's newly released from prison to serve as kind of a new community, to be a resource, a support network, and do some mentoring as well, and really kind of walk with that person on that initial journey.
Before we get into the circles of it in more detail, what kinds of prisoners do you take and or released prisoners do you take, and do they need different kinds of services?
Yes, they do need different kinds of services. One of the things we know from research and best practices is that anything, any kind of plan, anything should be individualized to meet the person's needs. Your first question, what kind of offenders do we take? The men and women who come to us run the gamut. The nature of their offenses run the gamut. So we have people who have committed theft, for example, to submit a drug habit. We have people who have OWI, 5th or 6th or 7th or 8th or 9th, 10th OWI. We have people who have committed homicide, domestic violence, and we have a large number of the men that we're working with are classified as sex offenders, which is kind of a broad continuum. And that includes, as we describe it to our volunteers as we're helping them understand in the training process, that can include, you know, the 20-year-old who had a 15-year-old girlfriend. And I'm a parent, and that doesn't sound great to me, but that's a very different type of offense than someone who is a predatory sex offender, violent sex offender, someone who's a pedophile. But that label, sex offender, runs that full gamut. So part of what we have to do is in the intake process, we're really trying to understand kind of where people fall on that continuum. We're also looking at their risk assessment, because certain people are at higher risk to reoffend. And what we know from the best practices, evidence-based practices, and the research is that for people who are at low risk of reoffending, and that's not necessarily based on the nature of the offense, but on all of these other factors like age, it can be the nature of the offense, but age has a lot to do with it, ties to the community. So someone who's a low-risk offender, if we provide too much service to them, we actually increase the likelihood that they will reoffend. And so we really are focusing our intensive services for people who would be classified as moderate to high risk. So that's kind of who we work with intensively through our Journey Home program. That's a case management type of program that's a pilot initiative of the United Way here in Dane County. And then the Circles of Support, and then we have our Phoenix Initiative, which is a peer-led support group for formerly incarcerated people, and Windows to Work, which is another focuses on vocational and educational reentry pieces.
Well, that sounds like a very good program. One of the things that I am curious about, though, a long time ago I set up a program in a community that involved putting people who no longer needed to be in the state mental health system because the new drugs had just come out as boarders in people's homes. And it was a community-based service. And one of the things the community said was that they wouldn't take anybody who was a murderer or a rapist. Now, I understand in your case you do take some people who have committed homicide. So are there any types of criminals that you won't take in order to protect basically your staff and your volunteers?
The answer is no. I mean, we will accept anyone who has requested to be part of the program. Now, the caveat to that, for the Circles of Support program, the volunteers in the circle have the ability, and we ask them to be honest and say, part of the process when they meet the person that we are thinking of matching them with, and we call that person who's released from prison the core team member, because they're kind of the spoke in the wheel, that circle is around that person. There's a file review so that they fully understand the nature of the offenses that this person has committed. And there's a conversation that takes place. And we ask the volunteers, and this is part of the training too, to really do some reflection and some introspection. Can you work with this person? Do you feel comfortable that you would be able to get past to work with them in a non-judgmental way, to really engage with them? And we have had some instances where a volunteer in a circle said, I just don't think I can work with this person. To be fair to them, I just don't think I can give 100%. And in those situations, what we will do, or for someone who's very high risk, we will form a circle of support around them that is comprised of our staff. But we do have, for example, in the office, we have a safety plan. We know who we do our best to know who we are accepting and who's coming into the programs. But we don't. There is no disqualifier in terms of if you did this, we cannot take you. Now, there are times when we might, for example, we have a satellite office in a small community. We would, if someone was a high risk, the nature of the contacts might happen someplace more public, so that we don't have a staff person who's sitting alone in a small office outside of Madison, meeting with someone who might potentially pose a risk to them. So we will make those accommodations to make sure that our staff and our volunteers are safe.
It sounds like a very good plan. Now, you are a church organization, and you find other churches to participate with you. So why is this something that churches might want to be involved with?
Well, in ours, we are a faith-based organization, so we're a private 501c3, and we're an interfaith organization. Why we think it's appropriate for them to be involved in this work is because it's a common call across faith traditions to welcome a stranger, and people who are returning from prison have been away. They are now a stranger. It's about forgiveness and belief and our faith in redemption, that people can and do change. And many of the men and women that we work with were raised in families and in churches and their faith and their spirituality is very important to them. And so for them to feel like they can be forgiven, that they can be welcomed back into the community, is really an important part of their healing and their feeling like they are reintegrating into the community. And we think any time you can, you know, and that's part of why we like to use volunteers, is that we are relational beings. And when people feel more connected to the community, it does do something to them in terms of how they look at the world, how they look at, committing the possibility of committing another crime. I always kind of liken it to, you know, stores Walmart or any of those places that have greeters at the front door who greet you. And the reality is they, you know, those folks aren't there because those stores really want us to feel happy and like loved. Those stores are there because there's research that shows when somebody looks you in the eyes and smiles and says hello and makes that connection, you're a little less likely to steal. So we kind of look at that. When there's a relationship, when there's a connection made between people, that's a positive thing as someone's reintegrating into the community.
That's fascinating. And then do you find, like, how many people would be in a circle? And would they be people who knew each other before? And do they, kind of tell me a little bit more about the circles.
So about the volunteers?
Yeah,
they, it's both. Each circle is 4 to 6 people. Most of the circles that we have are 4, and part of that is because to have 10 circles going, that's 40 volunteers, and so we like to have as many as we can going. But we've had some circles that were as many as 6. They are often people who've known each other before, and they're coming to us from a particular congregation. But we do have some circles of support because we also recruit through in the community at large, and so it's not a requirement that you're coming to us as a volunteer from a faith tradition. What as a faith-based organization, the programming is we're not evangelizing, but what we are doing is opening the door for the men and women who are participating in the program to have the freedom to talk about their faith or spirituality in the context of their reentry without running into issues with funding sources. Or so it's providing a safe place and a welcoming place for them to do that, but we are not going to be the people generally initiating that conversation. That's going to come from something that they want to do. But the men and women, so that's part of the training that we provide as well with the volunteers. The volunteers, but we do have community members who didn't know each other, and we bring them together as part of the circle. We have them go through the training together so that they start to coalesce as a group and feel connected to one another and build a sense of team there. So it's a mix. It's mixed. So we have students from the law school at University of Wisconsin. We have students from Edgewood College. We have students from Madison College. It's quite a diverse group of volunteers. We have people in the community who've just heard about the program and have called. So we have one circle of support, a men's group that was challenged by their minister. You know, they were doing Bible study, they were doing these things, and the minister said, "This is all great, but, you know, what are we really going to do to live this stuff out?" And so almost 8 years ago now, they formed a circle of support. They're still working with men coming out of the institution. They've been doing this so long that we've provided some additional specific training for them on working with people who are sex offenders, so that we have a circle that is a little more specialized for someone who is a high-risk sex offender, that they will consider working with them. And so it really is a mixed group, and the ages are varied from early 20s into, I think, our oldest circle of support volunteer is in his 80s.
And, wow.
He's part of that men's group.
Wow.
In fact, that group of men was just honored last year by the United Way of Dane County as one of the volunteers of the year award. So they're an amazing group of men.
Can you tell me, how do you screen them, and how do you, I used to run a neighborhood center, and one of the questions was making sure that people that volunteered were safe around for to be in the center and around the kids. So how do you, in fact, screen your volunteers, and how do you mm-hmm. train them?
It's a process. It's usually most of the volunteers, we have them come first through an volunteer information session where they hear about all of the different volunteer opportunities, because we have some children's programs for kids who have incarcerated parents. We have some other volunteer opportunities. So we want to make sure that they understand, you know, what different opportunities are, but also the different time commitments we ask and training commitments. So if they're interested in circles of support, they're going to come to that information session. From there, they will complete a volunteer application. They will go through an interview process and a background check. We have people who have conviction records who are circle of support volunteers. That doesn't preclude you, but we want to be very careful, for example, that we're not that we're protecting both the volunteers and the core team members. So, for example, if we have a volunteer who has a history of trauma, a woman, we probably will not assign someone whose criminal history is domestic violence to that circle. We may try to make sure that we put that person on a circle where maybe she's working more with women, or just not that type of domestic violence. Same thing, you know, if we have a volunteer who has a history of trauma, we might not want to put that person, or a male volunteer for that matter, who has a history of trauma, sex, you know, having been abused by a parent or adult, we may not want to, we're probably not going to put them in a circle with someone who that's the nature of their offense. And that's more, and it's not necessarily because they couldn't, but it's just a precaution that we take. So we do the screening. We have volunteers who are in circles of support right now who are people who successfully completed as a core team member a circle of support, and this is now in our restorative justice model. their way of helping repair the harm to the community by helping, by volunteering to be on a circle of support, helping someone else who's coming out of prison be successful in their reintegration. And I want to say, too, that the training is based, that we offer is based on the national standards developed through through Mentor, and there's not a, you know, the components include things like confidentiality, healthy boundaries, understanding the criminal justice system. There's a number of modules that people go through. The initial training that they go through after the whole screening process, they have to attend an 8-hour, it's a one day, it's on a Saturday, we have one coming up this Saturday, an 8-hour training session before they can actually start to be matched with someone. So it's designed to protect people. The boundaries piece is really important because people are very well intentioned, but we want to make sure too that they're not manipulated or taken advantage of in any way.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the restorative justice comment you just made?
Sure. Our model and our decision to enter into this to this work in some ways back in the late 1990s was looking at the fact that most people, as you said, come back to the community from prison, and people do need to be held accountable for what they've done, and we have a right to ask them to help repair the harm that they did. We also have to, and that's part of the restorative justice model, which comes out of the faith tradition. Restorative justice says we have to look at restoring the victim because they've been harmed. We have to look at the perpetrator and holding them accountable, but it also recognizes that many people who commit crimes have also been victimized in their life, and so how do we address that and how do we help restore them? And it also focuses on the community, holds the community accountable for the conditions we allow to exist, and also how do we repair the harm done to the larger community by this crime. So it's part of that model. And so part of what we, with the men and women that we work with, whether it's through our Journey Home program, Phoenix, Circles of Support, part of what we're also doing is working with them to say, you know, how recognizing the harm, recognizing how that has rippled out, not only to, you know, when someone commits a crime, it's like any of us, when we do something we shouldn't, that harms someone else, there are ripples to that. It's understanding how that ripples out and then looking at how can I repair some of that, how can I make amends. And one way to do that is by volunteering and giving back to the community. So we have men and women, especially early on when they're looking to build work histories and employment histories and in this economy, you know, volunteer work is a really good opportunity to give back to the community at the same time to learn some skills. So we try to connect people with volunteer opportunities in a larger community too.
And how do you evaluate your program?
We look at a few things. First and foremost, through our United Way and working with corrections, we look at recidivism rate. We look at each year, we provide a list of to the Department of Corrections as part of the agreement that we have. They look through their database. They use their database to look at who that we've worked with has gone back to prison. And so we can, with pretty good accuracy, say, okay, well, our recidivism rate is, you know, at this point, right around 10%.
Can you give
the other things that we look at, though, is who got a job, how many people got jobs, how many people found housing. I mean, those are two of the huge barriers that people face when they come out of prison. And finding residency, finding housing has gotten even more difficult in Wisconsin. We've had some legislative changes in the last year that have taken out a lot of protections to tenant rights. So it's become even more difficult. So we're looking at, did we get them connected with treatment if they had a mental health or substance abuse problem? Did they find permanent housing? Did they find a job? So we're looking at those benchmarks, too, because those are the goals that people typically are setting for themselves. So we're looking at whether they've met those goals.
Before we wrap up, I wanted to ask you one more question, and then can you give me an example of a success story?
Sure. John is somebody who came into the office on January 10th, I think it was January 10th, 2010, He'd been in prison for 8 years. He had family out here he wanted to reconnect with. He needed a job. He needed housing. He came into the office about 5 o'clock on the day he got out of prison in January wearing tennis shoes and that had holes in them and no winter coat. So part of that restorative justice model and part of that, you know, kind of welcoming the stranger, first thing that the staff did and as a way of building relationship is to say, sit down. We have a small emergency food pantry here. We're going to get you something to eat. Take a deep breath. We're going to find you some boots, and we're going to find you a coat. And then when your stomach's not growling and you're warm and we figure out where you're going to sleep tonight, we're going to start figuring the other stuff out. So they started to put together a reentry plan with him. Fortunately, he had some work skills, and we were able to help him find employment with a catering company. And he did really well there. He was able to find some temporary housing until we could connect him with some services to kind of reconnect with family. He reconnected, he and his wife and his kids are back together. And he stayed connected with the program, working with the case manager, checking in. His biggest challenge was he wanted to get everything done that first week, so it was kind of helping him take a step back and a deep breath and really focus on those things that he needed to get done. He had been in prison before. So we're really looking at how, you know, putting those pieces together, I'll jump to the end of the story, which is not really the end of the story, but if you came into our offices today, you might very well be greeted by John. He's on our staff now. He works full-time with us, helping other people who are coming back to the community from prison. That kind of evolved when he got laid off because of the economy and was looking for job opportunities. He wanted to give back, and he had remained active with the programs. And so to his parole agent's credit, his parole agent approved his working with other people who are coming out of prison. That doesn't always happen. So it's very much a collaborative effort, and he was originally placed with us through a community corrections employment program. He did such a great job in that training and orientation that we brought him on-job training and then made him a permanent staff person. So, and he's somebody who has a future here. I mean, he's been an amazing contribution to the staff.
Wow, what a great story. Now, finally, we're going to stop, but I wanted to ask you, what would be one or two places where people who are interested in the program for themselves or interested in for someplace else, some other church or some other community that would like to think about doing such a program, where should they go for more information?
Well, if they are in the Wisconsin area, they can certainly contact us. Our website is www.emum.org, and they can contact us through the website, and we can help them track down similar programs in their area if they exist. Otherwise, and I don't have all of those websites right in front of me, but the International Community Corrections Association has a wonderful website, some wonderful resources. They're at www.iccaweb.org. Highly recommend them, especially when looking at the research showing what works and what we know about evidence-based practices and corrections. The National Institute of Corrections and the Bureau of Justice Assistance. Those are the two websites I don't have memorized, but you can find them very easily. If you Google them, they also have some good resources. And I think some of those sites have listings of programs by state.
Well, thank you very much. I wanted to say this was really an interesting talk. And when we talked before, you mentioned a whole bunch of societal factors that influenced both why people went into prison and how they could and what happens to them when they come out. Things like the problems, and one of the things I know Mom does is advocacy, because mm-hmm. some of the questions about housing, some of the questions about the war on drugs, some of the questions about the racism that exists in our society, all of those things make a factor. And so I hope to talk to Linda again about the societal questions that also influence both why people end up in prison and what happens to them when they come out. But in the meantime, I'd like to thank you, Linda, And I'd like to thank the listeners, and please check again so that you can listen to Linda when we interview her again. And also you can check out previous programs that are archived on the website. Thank you very much.
For more information about Peggy and her work, please click on the host website icon on the WebTalkRadio.net page in front of you or follow her on Twitter. You can also click on her books or her blog. We look forward to seeing you down the rabbit hole again sometime soon for Alice in Political Land, Facts and Fantasy.